This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about happiness. So to start off, I've got some statistics from the Office for National Statistics, who carried out research into the state of happiness in the UK. Their survey of more than 300,000 adults across the UK found that 75 to 79 is the happiest age group for adults. Those aged 45 to 59 reported the lowest levels of life satisfaction, with men on average less satisfied than women. This age group also reported the highest levels of anxiety. So, Danielle, how do you feel about those first statistics?
I wasn't too surprised. You might guess that that might be the case with things that are going on in your life. I'd like to think as you get older, you might become happier and more content with your lot. And that middle age barrier is the, here it all is, I've got it all to deal with, the children are growing up, the bills are coming in, who am I, where am I? And then you probably... that changes a bit maybe then as you get older and the pressures of life may differ.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that's mirrored a little bit further in the research on why they thought this could be. But it certainly seems no coincidence to me that the happiest age group started at 65 when so many people retire.
Yeah.
So that one seems quite a clear correlation. So further from that survey, researchers said that one possible reason for lower happiness in that 45 to 59 age group was the burden of having to care for children and elderly parents potentially at the same time. The report also suggested that struggle to find work-life balance might also be a factor. And I think that makes a lot of sense with that age group. You know, it's interesting that so many of us have kids often when our careers are kind of at their peak, or you know, we're higher up in an organization than ever before, it does put a natural strain in place. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you work so hard and people work on their careers and, you know, they study and then get a job and then the panic sets in, I haven't got children, or, you know, for some people, and then, like you said, you're absolutely right, it all seems to come at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I wonder what people, you know, if people didn't feel, you know, the social pressure always of having children, whether actually people would. Yeah, and then I can imagine as you get older, you've got other things to, you know, life's, you realise how quick it goes. So I suppose you just chill and enjoy what's in front of you right now. Don't worry about all those other things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And in the survey, they also divided up different groups of people to look at how happiness can differ. So it found that married people had the highest levels of happiness, averaging 6.67 out of 10, higher than cohabiting, single, widowed or divorced people.
I mean, I'm sorry, but that has surprised me. It really has surprised me.
Go on.
Well, you know, I just don't think necessarily from, you know, people that I talk to and our friends and family, and it doesn't necessarily scream that being married is the way forward. I'd be interested to know actually how close, you know, cohabiting or single parents, the percentage is to the ones that are married. I would think it would be quite close in the ratings of happiness. I can't see it being a significant difference.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because I wasn't surprised by it, but I think there's other factors at play there. So in the interview for this episode, we talk a little bit about marriage and having kids and these kind of life commitments that many people see as really important milestones, as things to aim for. And so I kind of wonder if that's part of the reason that for many people, marriage is like a target to aim for, as one of the things for their happiness. And so therefore, maybe
they think they're happy, but they're not.
Yeah, well, I don't even know if it's that far, but maybe they're, you know, they're married, so that's one less thing to worry about.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who's single may have that additional thing to think about of, oh, I need to go on dates, I want to settle down with someone, how is my relationship going? Whereas there is a certain stability in marriage that I hear a lot of people talk about. So I wonder if it's that, to what extent it's reality or maybe just perceived stability, could be a different conversation.
absolutely. I think when you ask that question in a survey or questions within a group around your, your marriage state, or single status, that question, if you're married, may just get a tick. Like, yeah, that's done. Like you said, I've kind of crossed that bridge. Whereas a single person may just put a bit more thought into the answer and may not mark it as highly,
Perhaps.
Yeah.
So other things they found, people with jobs were happier than unemployed people, with part-time workers the happiest. Of those not working, retirees had the highest levels of happiness, followed by students. So again, that none of that really particularly surprises me, although it is interesting to note that of workers, part-time workers were happier. And I think that speaks to the kind of better work-life balance that this talked about earlier as a factor in some age groups being less happy.
I absolutely agree, and I draw on my own experience, Bobby. Actually, for the last 3 months is the first time in my whole working life that I've worked part-time. Although the time I'm not working, I'm still working, it's flexible. Mm. I work part-time and then the rest of my time is flexible. Much happier, because you've just got the opportunity to maybe do what you want to do or think about things or put time into yourself, self-care. Yeah. As opposed to just not having even that physical time to look after yourself, So I'm not surprised by that at all.
That's really key what you mentioned there, the flexibility. With me being self-employed, I'm roughly as flexible as I allow myself to be.
Yeah.
It depends how full I make my calendar. And so I definitely feel more freedom, even though I work more hours than most employed people.
Absolutely, I'm the same.
And then another thing they looked into was different religions. And so those who followed a religion, Hindus were marginally the happiest on average, followed by Christians and Sikhs. Those who followed no religion were the least happy. And again, I am biased as a Christian myself, so I would have my own ideas on why religion is beneficial. But I think, again, like marriage, this could be a lot about the other factors, that for those that follow organized religion, there is a certain community in that.
Yeah.
There's a routine to going to church or the mosque or the synagogue, wherever it is you're going. And so I think a lot of it would be those social aspects, potentially, not just the what religion do you follow.
Absolutely, definitely not just what religion do you follow, and I do agree it would be the social aspects, but I do also think it's the being non-religious myself. I also think it's that reasoning that comes with it, that understanding. Sometimes maybe people who don't follow a religion or the structure of religion, your mind can go anywhere it wants to go. You could think things happen for all sorts of reasons. I think when you're religiousness, you may tend to have kind of more answers for things that may otherwise worry other people. You may find comfort in that. So you're right, there's the social element, which I think is huge, the community element, but also that reasoning, that justification of maybe certain events or things that happen in your life that can be quite calming.
Yeah. And I know certainly from my own background, a lot of people take great comfort from that, being able to say with confidence, it'll work out. These things happen as for a reason. And a lot of people think that way anyway, but I think religion can really strengthen that because it sort of structures it. You know, you have an outside power or, a bigger kind of community ethos maybe that can take some of the pressure off you having all the answers.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting. All these different factors potentially play into happiness. And in the episode, we talk a lot more in depth about what happiness actually is. A lot of these factors really play into contentedness, which we talk about in the episode as well, as opposed to necessarily all being as direct. Marriage makes you happy. It may be more indirect that being married can give you a certain structure and support in your life that makes it easier to be happy in. I wonder if it's more that kind of indirect correlation.
Yeah, I totally agree. It'd be great to explore that.
So one more bit of research is from Laurie Santos, who's a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale. In looking into what it takes to be happy, she found many studies that support that happiness is something that requires a conscious effort, is not easy, and takes time. So I really like that finding, because that's very much how I view happiness. oftentimes people can confuse it with something you should feel constantly. You know, the ideal is constant happiness, whereas that's actually not how humans work. You know, it's something that comes and goes as any emotion would. You can't be constantly happy. There's always going to be things in your life you don't enjoy, things that are more tricky or more difficult than others. And so that happiness kind of does go up and down. From a mental health perspective, of course, when you're unable to be happy at any point, especially with tasks or activities that normally bring you joy, yeah, that's when it's a danger. And that can be a really significant symptom in depression, for example. Also from her research, she found 5 ways that have been shown to increase happiness. So those are more sleep, at least 8 hours a night, less social networks and more real life connections, spending more time with family and friends, meditation, and writing lists of gratitude. How do you feel about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I love those. I mean, sleep's huge. We know that sleep is a big factor in how we feel every day, and especially with regard to mental health. People who have poor sleep generally report, you know, poor levels of mental health as well. And the social factors around, you know, social networking and things like that. It depends on how you perceive social network and what you find it for. Some people who don't necessarily have a friends and family group that's in front of them that is strong and that they actually connect with, but connect more with people that are healthy relationships via social networking. So it's difficult to always necessarily label those things, but the undercurrent, I think, is a genuine connection, whether that's through social media because, you know, you've really connected with a group or an individual via social media that you get a lot of happiness out of, whether that's a parent or a family or friends. I think underlying it's that connection and that true connection that is a factor. Driving force.
Right, absolutely. And that's a really good point that these are overall findings. So for many people, spending time with family or certain friends will really stress them out.
Absolutely.
And so it won't be helpful at all.
You can't choose your family.
So, you know, it can vary from person to person, but the way I see these findings is there's, if I was to put them in 2 general boxes, it's around creating real connections with people.
Yeah.
And feeling kind of understood, and I think part of a community to an extent.
I do.
And then the other side of that is self-care. You know, a lot of them are how well you look after yourself. So with that, we'll get into the episode with Richard Nichols. He's a really incredible hypnotherapist and psychotherapist, and he also hosts his own podcast called The Richard Nichols Podcast. So we'll talk more about that in the episode and how he's learned to better understand happiness through both his own experience and also with the clients he's worked with. I'm really delighted to interview him. He was so brilliant to me, so insightful. And I was also very lucky to appear on his podcast, which we'll mention at the end of the episode. So we'll get into that interview in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So I'm Richard Nichols, and I present the Richard Nichols Podcast, which is a podcast all about psychology, psychotherapy, because I'm a psychotherapist. And I became a psychotherapist, bizarrely, because as a kid, at first I wanted to be an actor. And when mentioning that to the careers advisor, I was told, you need to have a proper job. That's just a dream. What do you want to do for your career? And I said, no, genuinely, I want to be on the stage, or I want to be in front of a camera. And I said, yeah, no. What are you going to really do? Take that down a level. I said, well, okay. Well, maybe I could be a radio DJ. And she said, again, let's just think sensibly here. What are you going to do? And I said, well, quite like the idea of social work. And she said, oh, no, that's a thankless task. You don't want to do that. Looking at your mock exams here, looking at this, you're probably going to need to be involved in languages. You probably need to do something with German or French or English or something like that. I thought, oh, OK, you've clearly made your mind up way before I sat down. And it annoyed me. But it did. It annoyed me, but I listened. I listened and took it on board and believed what she said. So I never became an actor to a degree, although I do in amateur dramatics. I do a lot of stuff on stage. I love it. I love being the centre of attention now. Things are very different now. But going through that sort of strange teenage anxiety that a lot of teenagers do, self-esteem wasn't particularly good. the idea of being the centre of attention was a bit of a distraction anyway from the real me, I guess, because if we can play this comedian, if we can play this clown, then the real me doesn't get seen. And the real me was quite an anxious, nervous guy. So maybe acting at that age probably wasn't the best thing for me. So I thought, maybe I can hide behind a microphone. So I joined, this is age 16, I joined the local hospital radio station. And the first thing they do is put you on the wards to go and chat to everybody, to go and talk to the patients. So it properly got me out of my comfort zone, properly taught me how to feel the fear and do it anyway, to go and talk to people, because I'd not had much experience of that, because I was quite anxious. But what I discovered is that somebody might have a physical problem. You know, they've broke their leg, they've got some serious issues. These are not mental problems. They're in pain, but it's physical pain. All I would do is just sit and chat to them, and they'd need less pain relief medication. Sometimes they'd call the nurse because they're struggling. And I'd see that the nurses, because this is back in the 90s when the nurses used to have smoke breaks, and they'd be hiding in a room exchanging documents, and there's like one nurse looking after everybody, and I see a patient has called the nurse, and I thought, that nurse is not going to come for a good 5 minutes, so I go and sit down. Hello, Flora, I noticed you called the nurse. Is everything all right? Is there anything I can get for you at all? Do you need anything? She said, oh no, I just want my pain relief a little bit earlier tonight. I'm in a lot of pain. And I said, well, when I spoke to you earlier on, you were telling me about your granddaughter. Tell me a little bit more about her. And this is I was 17 probably at this point. By the time I got good at this. But I was able to distract them from their pain. And I thought, what is it about... And they'd cancel the nurse caller. They wouldn't need the nurse then. And I'd chat to them about their granddaughter or whatever. Then I'd go off and talk to somebody else. And as I walked away, you'd see Flora starting to fidget a little bit, and she'd start to get her pain back. And she'd then call the nurse. And I thought, all she needed was a distraction, just a temporary distraction. And that got me quite involved in how the brain works. And so I got involved in hypnosis. And that's always fascinated me, how the brain works and how you can trick yourself into thinking and feeling differently. And because I mentioned it to some of the doctors that worked at the hospital, because there was a social club there at the time. And the doctor would say, well, it's just a type of hypnosis. You were just sort of distracting them. And, you know, that can be quite useful. And I thought, I want to learn about this. Hypnosis had always interested me, so I did a hypnotherapy course. And then, of course, as a hypnotherapist, you get people who just want to learn to have some new habits, accelerate learning, leave food on their plate to help them lose a bit of weight and so on. But people would start to come with more serious issues. They'd come with more, maybe even personality disorders, things like that. So I then got extra training to become a psychotherapist and took it to the next stage. And throughout all of that, I never lost my interest in using a microphone. Because as a teenager, I wanted to be that radio DJ. And then in probably 2010, I think it was 2010, I started making a lot of audio content for my patients to listen to in between their sessions. And eventually I put that out to the public and made it go live in 2010, towards the end of 2010. And now I can tell the careers advisor how crap they were now, because I kind of am a kind of radio DJ, and I do some acting. I mean, I'm rehearsing for Ben-Hur at the minute, or the bizarrely comedy version, very funny. I'm doing all the things that I want to do now, but that didn't start until I was in my mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could go back in time and tell that younger me, you know what, that careers advisor just didn't know what they were talking about. You know, maybe you should have believed in yourself a bit more. But I can't go back, but we can go forward. And that's what my podcast is all about, is helping people to move forward, helping them to understand a little bit more about themselves, a bit more of emotional intelligence.
So that's really interesting to hear how you were encouraged down what sounds like quite a narrow path, because you have so many different areas to your work now, and instead you went to careers advice and they just looked at your grade and were like, okay, we're going to put you in this box. And that's very much an experience I had, that, you know, I grew up in school and everything was geared towards university, and I never thought that would be right for me. And turns out it really wasn't. You know, me being at university very briefly was the worst time for my mental health ever. So it's interesting to hear that you've had a slightly similar experience. Do you feel that it was also something that contributed to your issues around confidence or anxiety as well?
They'd been there for quite a while, I guess. But it hit a peak when I was coming towards the end of my GCSEs, because I created this character, this clown, this comedian that everybody expected of me. And it was a mask. It was just as a way of hiding the real me. Now, a lot of people do that and it doesn't cause a problem because they sort of grow out of it. But I focused on it. It became who I was. And the reason it caused a big issue was because I didn't have the confidence to go to college, let alone university. I wanted to continue with my education because I got good grades. But the school I went to that had a sixth form college bolted onto the side of it didn't do the courses I wanted to do. They didn't do things in audio that I was interested in at the time. What I should have done is gone somewhere else, but I didn't have the confidence. This is the school I'd been to since I was 12. I only know this place. I have to stay here with the teachers that I know and the people that I trust. It has to be here. And they said, well, in that case, the only A-levels we can offer you are physics and English. And although I was very interested in English, English A-level, I thought, yeah, great, I'm quite interested in language and literature, poetry and plays. Love it, let's soak it all up. Can I just do that? And they said, oh, no, you have to do two A-levels and at least a stack more GCSEs. And they said, the only one we can offer you is physics. Now, I failed my maths GCSE. So they said, well, you're going to have to retake that. That can be one of the extra GCSEs that you do. I failed again, got a D again. I say failed, it's a D, but they needed more. I was doing A-level physics, but I didn't want to. That was not what I wanted to do. So halfway through my A-levels, we do the first year, and they go, your English is fantastic. It's really nice to have you as part of this college. You really do take part. This is fantastic. But you can't stay here because you clearly are no good at physics. I go, no, I didn't even want to do this. Well, sorry, you're going to have to go. And I just got the first job I could find before they told me, go now. Because they said it would be, you know, this would be at the end of the year. I left in something like April. I thought, that's it. If this isn't going to come to anything, I've got to go. So I just found a job and did this job in this warehouse for 7 years before I went, hang on a minute. And now I got a lot better then. My mental health had improved. I did a lot of therapy and stuff like that and got myself where I needed to be. And it helped me to realise this guy in this warehouse office answering the telephone, that isn't who I am. And I've been here for 7 years, frightened of change. Yeah. Come on, let's do something with this. And I've been so fascinated with therapy and hypnosis and so on because of my work at the hospital that I thought, if I can merge these together, my interest in microphones and audio and voiceover stuff, and couple that with being a therapist, then I've got a career. And that's why I became a hypnotherapist and then a psychotherapist, because I just wanted an excuse to play with microphones.
Wow. It's interesting to me how you've kind of internalised, by the sound of it, the expectations other people had of you. So that then when you left, you ended up in, you know, a warehouse. It sounds like you went for quite a random job that you came across, as opposed to what worth you actually had to offer. And that's where it can be so dangerous with being too definitive over young people. You know, I know for me growing up, I was changing my mind every 5 minutes on what I wanted to do. And I remember having a lot of experiences where adults would ask me, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'd give them more than one answer. And you're not allowed to give more than one answer, apparently. And yet, you know, through my work now, most of the people I come across have various projects that they're working on. I don't know many people in my world that are just one thing. And I think that's to lead on to our theme for today, happiness. I think that can be very dangerous in terms of how we see our happiness, that so often it's tied to, you know, get the right job or get the family set up, get a house. It can become very materialistic and narrow. And actually, all of those things are external as well.
The fact that they're external is difficult because they can be taken away. We can lose our job.
Yeah.
We can even lose our family. And if your only source of happiness or pride is, for example, your son, And now my son is my best friend. I'm not his, because I'm a 43-year-old man and he's only 14. But he is my best bud. And there's a part of me that's a bit worried about that, and a part of me that says, well, it is what it is. He can't be my only source of pride, because he's going to go. He's going to leave. He's going to fly the nest, and then it's just me and my wife. Which is fine, he says. No, it is. It's absolutely fine. No, she's never going to listen to this. It's absolutely fine. But genuinely, no, that's fine. But it's only going to be fine because I know we have to make it fine. It's not going to be fine by itself. Because when he goes, and it is just me and my wife, and we look at each other, there's going to be a big part of us that goes, great, we've got more space. I can finally have my little study up in the spare room. That'll be great. But we're going to miss him tremendously, and we'll have very little to talk about unless we realise what else is going on in our lives. And even my wife, she can't be my only source of happiness. But what will probably happen is everything's going to be fine. But what if it's not? Now, I'm an optimist, I'm a positive guy, but my wife could be taken away from me. I need to make sure that I know how to be happy. I need to know that I can be happy without my iMac or my Audi. Or my home, or the view out of this window. I want to know that I can be happy with or without all that stuff. And I think that's where a lot of problems lie, that we think that we have to collect things, that things have to be external to give us happiness. And that does tend to work for a short period, but yet we'll still every year think, oh, I need to upgrade my phone. Another 700 quid. What, really? I'm sure that phone you had last year is still fine, but it doesn't make me feel good anymore. Well, no, it's not going to, because that's not how capitalism works. That's not how companies work. Businesses want your money.
Yeah.
And whether it's money through adverts that you just see as clickbait, or whether it's genuine cash that you're handing over because there's the next shiny object, we need to be aware of hedonic habituation, that we get used to things. So whether it's a 20 grand car, a 400 grand house, you know, even something like that is not have anywhere near the pleasure it did for those initial days. And we need to learn that we can appreciate all those things that we've got before we let them degrade in our minds.
Right, absolutely. And I think what's really key about what you're saying is the importance of being happy independently. You know, and that's even that within itself, there's misconceptions around what happiness actually is. But I think so often in our society, we do try and put our happiness in things or in people. You know, we get into a relationship and we've seen all the Disney films and there's a happy ever after they get married. And so if only you have the marriage and you can put your happiness in them, then you'll be happy. But of course, that's not how it works, and that's not even healthy. You know, you should be going in as someone that still wants to work on yourself. Your partner will also want to work on themselves. You don't have to be going into a relationship perfect, but it's also very dangerous to go in thinking, I need a relationship and then I'll be happy and okay.
There has been multiple studies over the years looking at both the positives and the negatives of getting married, of having children, and yet people will set those as goals. They'll say, I'll be happy then. I'll be happy when I've got a kid.
Yeah.
Am I happier having him in my life than if he's not in my life? Well, I don't have access to the universe where I don't have him in my life, so all I can think about is him being taken away from me now. And of course, that devastates me. Just the thought of it cripples me inside. And you compare it with similar people in similar lifestyles who don't have children and compare their happiness and play around with all the statistics and work out, you actually see that having children makes us quite significantly unhappier. It gives us way more things to worry about, way more stress, gives us far less sleep.
And of course, we're not saying at all, don't have kids, but it's important to be mindful of the kind of messaging we're surrounded by, because as much as there's that with the media that we grow up on, it's also the same with possessions as well, that there's this constant advertising that's trying very systematically to tap into how our brains work. How can we make people believe that this is the route to their happiness? How can we make this shopping experience release hormones in their brain so that they feel happy and keep doing this? How can we make buying with us a habit. And that's can be incredibly dangerous and is really important, I think, to be mindful about, because really, as much as there are wonderful companies out there, for the most part, they're more interested in your dollar, your money, than they are your actual happiness and experience. And so, you know, I think these are all quite dangerous factors. But also, one thing I'm keen to talk to you about is the misconception, I think, on what happiness is in general. A lot of people that I meet think of happiness as a kind of baseline, that that's where they should be in their life. Maybe they think, I need the house and the car and the partner or whatever to get there, but they think that's the baseline they're aiming for. Whereas realistically, as people, happiness isn't our baseline. It's more so contentedness.
Yes, that's exactly when you were saying, as if we could try and define happiness here, which is something that academics have been trying to do for a very long time. That the word contented is what that our level of content is what popped into my head, that says, if we can look at that, how contented have I been lately with what I have? How contented am I with my life? Because I had a client about three years ago, something like that. And I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning. No, I know he won't mind me mentioning it, because I asked him if I could put it in the book, and I did. He went to India with his work, and he would do that a couple of times a year. So he got quite familiar with some families that were over there. So when he retired, he would still go back once a year and see them. And they had nothing. This family, these families that he went to see, they had nothing. And yet they were happier than the people in his immediate surroundings here in the UK. And he couldn't get his head around it. Well, no, he could, because he was able to work it out and go, well, of course, their values are in a different place. He took over some clothes for one of these, this guy that would always tour with him and take him around places. He took him over some clothes. He took him about maybe it was three pairs of trainers, something like that, and said, well, these are for you, because they were difficult to come by in wherever he was. And he said, why so many? He said, well, they're for you. They're a gift. He said, but I only have 2 feet. And he gave the rest away. And I think that is what makes us happy. I'm not saying we've got to give away all our shoes, although I wish my wife would.
Another way for you to get more space.
Please, just one more wardrobe, just for my shirts, please. But it's what giving things away represents. That sense of community, that sense of belonging, that sense of I have value in this place. And when somebody said to me a couple of weeks ago, what would be a quick thing that somebody could do right now to make them instantly happier? And I was kind of put on the spot, and I thought, oh, crikey, what, right now? Oh, I don't know. Well, I can't remember what I said. But immediately after the interview ended, I thought, of course I know. The easiest thing you could do is just go and take a tin of baked beans to the food bank. And they're everywhere. There's one in nearly every supermarket. That would take you 20 minutes. And instantly make you happier. Here, in this room that we're recording this in, I've got this one's empty now, this massive, how big is this? 4.5 litre scotch bottle. And there's this, this one's full. This is a big brandy bottle, contains, 4.5 litres. There's usually about 50 quid in this. And
It's full of coins, in case listeners can't hear that.
4.5 litres of brandy. No. It's full of 5p's and 20p's and pennies and 2p. It's full of all these coins. And if once a year you tip all that out with your family and count it all out and find there's 50 quid, and then you sit down and go, what are we going to do with this 50 quid? Where's it going to go? Now, years ago, that would have just been turned into £10 notes and spent in the pub. I've got a bit wiser now, because although that's a nice experience, maybe going out for a meal, that's a nice experience, but that money could be far better spent elsewhere and give far greater pleasure. When you can see on a website that helped educate somebody in another country for a month, that you've helped provide a roof over somebody's head, how many sleeping bags could you get? Maybe not very many, but how many Greg sausage rolls could you get with all of those pennies and give them out to a load of homeless people in shelters, in doorways? That could easily be 30 or 40 different bits of happiness. If I did that once a week, every week for a year, I'm going to start thinking of myself as quite a decent person and actually feeling that I'm contributing to society rather than just going to work and then coming home, watching whatever crap is on the telly that night and then going back to work again the next day. There's got to be more to us than that, hasn't there? Hasn't there?
Right. And you've raised a really important point there as well of how a lot of people view happiness as something to hoard, that you need to try and gather up all the things that you think will make you happy and hold on to them, and no one else can go near them. And of course, that's actually quite an isolating way to live.
You've hit the nail on the head there, because money represents everything that evolutionarily we associate with safety. It's a roof over our head and it's food in our belly. As long as we've got those things, we're going to be okay. Now, a million years ago, yes, that was all we needed, was berries and a cave. And maybe a sense of community, maybe people around us to keep us safe. And that's what money kind of represents now. And because of the society we've got, we're trying to collect all these things. We're trying to collect all these pounds, these dollars. We're trying to collect money, thinking that it's going to make us feel better. But it doesn't. But it does isolate us. And it does make us selfish. And because we don't feel, when we've got quite a lot of money, we don't feel as if we need other people's help, we tend to push people away. And actually, that is a massive recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. Isolating yourself, becoming a hermit. But we do. But there's one common experiment where you get people to almost bump into somebody, but they drop some pencils. Right. And you see how many pencils they help pick up, and you can just count. And you get a control group that just walks out of a door, and somebody goes, oh, and they drop their pencils, and you see if they pick them up. Then you get another group who, whilst they were in the room beforehand, were doing something related to money. If they were doing something related to money, they'd pick up far fewer pencils. All because all they were doing was unscrambling an anagram. And some of the words that they were unscrambling were related to business. That is enough to prime our brain to think about the value of money. That means that when somebody needs some help right in front of us, we don't help them. We're far less likely to help them. Far less likely to be liked and appreciated and feel that we're contributing to society.
So that's really interesting, and it's reminding me of a conversation I had not too long ago with a good friend, and he's retired, and he was saying how something he notices a lot in his generation is how they've gone through their whole lives in a way that can lead them to be quite isolated. And then when they retire and maybe a spouse dies, or, you know, they're no longer at work and they're naturally around less people, then they hold it against others for not seeing them more. But, you know, he says you only need to look at people's houses. You know, many people start off living with their family. They then move out like I did and move into a flat, and they're around quite a lot of people. And then as time goes on, you maybe want a semi-detached, and then you want a detached, and then perhaps you want to move into the countryside. And it becomes not only how can I have a bigger space and fill more things in and put all, you know, a lot of it is necessary with families growing, but it is quite material, and it also at the same time distances you from people. You build up less tolerance for others, because if you're not living in a flat anymore, you're not hearing other people's noise as much. And so it can create this isolation, and then people can be incredibly isolated in old age, and that is detrimental to their well-being. And yet this is very much how the system's set up, because happiness is put in things and the physical outside world around you rather than where you're at within yourself. And so that's why I think it's really important, that distinction between contentedness and happiness, because contentedness is a lot more achievable with possessions and with money, whereas happiness is something that comes and goes. If you were happy constantly, many people in mental health professionals would actually be a bit concerned about you. Are you going through some kind of mania? And, you know, it's actually completely natural and human to have the ups and downs, to have the happy days and to have the sad days. And instead, it's something that takes a lot of work. And I see a lot of that with what areas you're involved in, like your book. You've put together so many wonderful techniques for people where they can practice happiness as a skill, and not just something that if I have all these things, it will naturally come to me.
You reminded me of a play I was in, but it was an Alan Ayckbourn play called Time of My Life.
Right.
And in this play, one of these characters is looking back on the fact that his dad has just died, or recently died about a year ago. And the last time he saw him was at a family event where this man had said, "This is one of life's truly happy times. I'm truly happy today." This son changed his outlook because he realised he'd never said that to himself, ever. He'd never said, "I am happy now." And there was this line that I'm going to paraphrase, but it was something along the lines of, "Rarely do we say, I am happy now. We say, I was happy then, or we say, I'll be happy when. But rarely do we say, I am happy now."
Mm.
It's right. The author's completely right. We look back when we're in a bad place and go, "Well, I was happy then. That was a good day. I just wish I'd noticed." Because we need to notice it. On those rare days in the UK where we get a bit of blue sky and a bit of warm sun on our head and shoulders, we need to be able to go, "This is nice. This is really nice. What a lovely day." And it's, I don't know why it's frowned upon to be able, but it is frowned upon. There's almost a stigma of being happy, of appreciating things.
Well, it comes back to that idea of kind of hoarding it, that your happiness somehow takes away from someone else's experience. But actually, it's not about the comparison, because the only baseline is your own, is what, you know, where are your own emotions? What's a good day for you? Actually, other people's experience doesn't have a huge bearing on what's going on inside your head. And when it does, it can be very dangerous. You know, I have that all the time with people that I meet. You know, they'll tell me a difficult experience they've gone through and then immediately backtrack and be like, "Oh, but, you know, so many people have it worse." And I'm like, but that doesn't undermine your experience. In the same way, your happiness and your good day doesn't take away from anybody else's. And, you know, I think that's something we can all be guilty of, kind of systemizing our emotions. That if, you know, if only I do these things, and that's something I can be guilty of a lot myself, that I work very hard and sometimes I need to take a step back and just enjoy where I'm at. But it can be tempting when you commoditize your emotions to be like, "Okay, well, I'm happy now, so I quickly need to do 10 more tasks to maintain the happiness." And what happens? I get stressed and then I'm not happy anymore. The most natural thing would be for me to actually take the afternoon, think you're in a good place, go spend time with a friend, go slow down, go enjoy it, go enjoy the progress, rather than it always being, "Okay, I've had this much progress, where's the next bit?"
It's hard to practice what you preach, but but we do have to stand back sometimes and go, "But I understand this." And you'd offer somebody else some advice about if they got a problem, if they were feeling stressed and overwhelmed with stuff. You'd know just what to say to them. But we need to say it to ourselves, because we do hear ourselves speak. You know, we are a constant voice in our own heads. And if what we're always saying is, "That's not good enough, you need to do more. That's not, your house isn't big enough, you need a bigger one. Your car isn't expensive enough. You know, look at the neighbours." And
comparison is the thief of joy, don't they say?
It really is. And there's no good in keeping up with the Joneses. And when that cartoon strip first started in, I think, the 1950s or something like that in the States, in this newspaper, people were able to look at these two families, and this one family, I forget their name, the MacArthurs, I think was the name of the family, having to keep up with their neighbours, and you're laughing at this family. "Oh, look at them, they're so daft." But we have, and we do, we still do that now. We've got, you remember Keeping Up Appearances from the 90s, the sort of the hyacinth bouquets of the world. We laugh at that because we know that isn't right. You shouldn't be that. But then we are. But then we do look at what our neighbours have got, and we do look at the Instagram holidays, and we do wish that we were having that life too. But we're comparing our worst with everybody else's best again. No one's going to take a photograph of and put on Instagram the dirty toilet in the hotel. Oh, some might, I guess, but they don't. They take a photograph of the view, and not on a rainy day. They do it on a nice day so that when you look at their holiday, you go, I'm only seeing the good things. Now, that's great if what you're going to do when you've taken that photograph yourself is look back through your life and see, I've had some positive experiences, because that's good. We do want to delete the dirty toilet and the waiter that dropped the dinner. You know, we want to delete those things. We want to remember the good things. So, yeah, sure. We should be photographing and documenting some of these good things to help us. But we need to look at it when it's when we are somebody else viewing it, watching, looking in. That's for their benefit, not for me.
Right. And I think even further than that, there can be such danger in how we internalise that in our own behaviour. Young people now grow up in this social media age, and so they see all their friends doing this kind of highlight reel of their lives, and they start doing it themselves. And so that's something that can also be so dangerous, that you start comparing your life to your own highlight reel. And that's when it can really be internalised. And that's just somewhere where it's incredibly dangerous, because you're setting an unrealistic expectation for your life of the perfectionism that isn't reality. And it just feeds into further this idea of you have to make progress to be happy. Whereas actually, if you really think about it, surely the ideal is to be happy a lot of the time on the way up. You know, appreciate the things you have as you go along. And that doesn't mean you have to be happy constantly, but appreciate the things as you go. And something I've been looking into a lot more recently myself is minimalism. Actually trying to take a lot of this power out of the possessions and have less things. And I do find myself appreciating them more. I have less things to clean, for a start, which is wonderful. But also, you know, there's less clutter, and I can see possessions that I most love because they're the ones I'm keeping, the ones that continue to bring me joy. And it takes your mindset out of the grab all the things and instead highlights to you what you like about what you've already got.
Absolutely, ideally. If you can be happy in the first place, then any changes you might make in your life are bonuses. When somebody comes to me for help with weight loss, for example, specialising in hypnosis, I do sometimes get people who don't have mental health issues, but they've got some stumbling blocks. There's things that are getting in the way. So they'll come to me and say, oh, I want you to wave your magic hypnosis wand at me. Like, okay, let's see if we can do that. So I'll ask them why. Okay, why do you want to lose weight? Let's look at some of these goals, some of these benefits. And they'll say, oh, I'm just not happy. And as a psychotherapist, I have to stand back and go, well, maybe we should be teaching you how to be happy first and then just see what happens with the weight. Because when we look there, the weight sort of drops off by itself, because it's easier to make the healthy choices. It's easier to leave food on your plate. It's easier to feel motivated to go for a run because you're in a good place in the first place. And that's where we need to be. And yet we look, if we're not careful, at our body shape or about our weight and say, well, that needs to change so that I'll be happy. Well, that's not how it works. That's dangerous.
Yeah, and it's also a slippery slope. You know, particularly something like weight loss. You get it where you think, okay, if only I lost a dress size, if only I lost this many pounds, then I'd be happier. And then you almost train yourself with that cause and effect. And so I've known that with people in my own life where it's got as far as becoming an eating disorder because they see happiness as being progressively thinner. And there's only so long you can play that game until it gets incredibly unhealthy.
And we can see that in so many places, whether it's a personal best on a park run or it's how much money you earn. If you're always thinking that you're supposed to be striving for more and more and more, it eventually becomes unrealistic. And to think that I can only be proud when I run 5K if I've done it in a second or two quicker than I did it last week, it's not achievable. As time goes by, you're going to hit a limit that says, this is the best I can do, and that needs to be okay.
Exactly. And I think that feeds into a lot of our choices. I don't enjoy running, so I'm not going to do it. If I did need to get fitter, I would find a way that I enjoy. And that's the difference between the happiness as you do the thing, because then it's not about the goal. You know, I love skiing. To me, skiing doesn't even feel like exercise, yet it works almost every muscle in your body. So that's the way I try and make my choices now.
And yet something like skiing or even swimming, somebody might see that as a treat. Now, my son, he goes swimming every Thursday with a friend because he likes the idea of catching up with a mate and going for a swim, and they laugh and they joke and they probably splash, but they'll do some swimming, they'll do some exercise. He doesn't see it as exercise, he's just going to the swimming baths because it's not a chore.
Yeah.
It's not looking, as you say, for that end goal of, I'm just going to push myself.
Well, absolutely, because for many people, them performing at their best often means them at work. And you'd never say to anybody, work all the time. You know, you have to sleep, you have to rest. I can't podcast 24 hours a day. No matter how great it is and how much I enjoy it, I won't enjoy it for very long if I'm not sleeping. You've highlighted a really good point there of how so often we're encouraged to live in the future. You know, we go into the future for all the progress we want to see, all the things we think that will bring our life more joy. And then we go into the past for the good memories we like to reflect on and, you know, uploading to our Instagram feed and whatever it is. And then what gets lost is the you that's in the here and now,
yeah,
to the extent where it could actually be quite wasteful. If you're doing all this work to create a happier life, but you're not living in the present, you won't even feel the feelings because you're so focused on what that next thing is. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of mental illnesses have an element of living in the past or the future. Often people talk about anxiety, living in the future, worrying about all the things that could happen down the road, and depression being more reflective on the past and things you've struggled with and living more and identifying with that past struggle. And, you know, I don't see that as a coincidence that there is that kind of correlation.
But it's difficult to work out how to get out of that.
So one thing I'm really interested in with your work is how you've put together a book all about these kind of exercises you can go through to practice and build happiness as a skill. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, my podcast, as you know, has been kicking around for quite a few years. And when I was approached by a publisher to say, look, you've got a big fan base, we want you before Penguin do, which literally happened. Penguin banging on the door, literally the week after, I thought was quite sneaky. Never mind, sorry, Penguin. They said, let's have a look through the statistics, through the analytics of your podcast, and see which are the popular episodes. And because I've been doing it for so long, there were so many to plough through. Every time there was anything in the podcast title with the word happy in it, there was a massive spike.
Wow.
People were going back and listening to it. Or they were finding that one because it was the word happy they were looking for. How to be happier, 10 tips to a happier life, things for happiness. And the publishers were like, well, you've got to do something about being happy because clearly the public aren't. This is the one that's going to sell the most books. I thought, okay, I'll play that game, that's fine. They're interested in what's going to sell the most books. I'm interested in helping the most people. We can all live happily ever after if we work together on this. And so I sat down and looked through the research that people have been doing over the years, Dan Gilbert, Sonia Leibomirsky, and a load of other academics that, I mean, I'm not an academic guy. Like I say, I didn't even go to university. So the studies, they're really complicated. But if I can pour through them and work out what it means in real terms, in layman's terms, and explain it to the public that says, this experiment is really useful, but this is why, and this is how you can use it in your life. And this is why maybe you've got something in your life has been contributing to your depression. And it across the board, we keep coming back to sometimes the same foundations, which is about gratitude, about appreciation, about enjoying the now and not worrying about the future. So it's worth looking, yes, at what evolutionary psychology has been saying over the years, that what can we do in our life that makes us happy? Is it going to be around keeping ourselves safe? Yes and no. Hiding under the duvet from the monsters isn't going to keep us safe when there are no monsters. When the monster is something that's internal,
mm-hmm.
It's not a real tiger. It's just a tiger that belongs a million years in the past. But our body says, I'm not happy right now, and so I need to face something. And we get fight or flight. And we never know what we're supposed to do. Do we punch our way out of something, or do we hide from it? And depending on who we are and our experiences and our habits, we'll go one way or the other. But actually, what we probably need to do sometimes is just stop. Take a few deep breaths and go, okay, what do I want to see happen next?
That's it. And I think with our lives nowadays, you know, we do have those evolutionary features that often don't serve us anymore, because now it's not a tiger that we need to either run or hide about. It's a traffic warden. It's your boss being unfair to you, giving you extra work at 5 minutes to 5. These things where actually neither of those solutions are any help to us. And so it's about how can we instead be more conscious of how to support our mental health, how to create a healthier baseline of contentedness with the tools that we have, because fight or flight, for the most part, isn't serving us anymore.
No, it's really, really not.
And so we will wrap up there. If people want to find your podcast, they can just search the Richard Nickel podcast anywhere podcasts are found. And I actually did an episode not long ago, a special one-off one for Mental Health Awareness Week, if you want to hear me be interviewed for a change. And so thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been brilliant.
Absolute pleasure, Bobby. Thank you for having me. You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.